From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. How much do you know about Araminta Ross? Her face is slated to start appearing on the $20 bill by 2030. She's the first American woman in history to lead a military raid that emancipated over 700 people, and one of the most important abolitionists in history. You might know her by another name, Harriet Tubman. But when it comes to Harriet Tubman's legacy, an important part of her lived experience is often overlooked: her disability. With July being Disability Pride Month, we wanted to celebrate Harriet Tubman as an icon and learn more about her identity from someone who finds her often rightly celebrated, but seldom understood.
I think even though many of us may have known that Harriet Tubman suffered an injury in her adolescent years, without the language of disability, we have a harder time understanding and really recognizing the importance of what these elements in her life meant to her and how they affected her.
That's Taya Miles, a National Book Award winner and the Michael Garvey Professor of History at Harvard University. In her latest book, Night Flyer, Harriet Tubman and the Faith, Dreams of a Free People, Taya writes about the somewhat unsung aspects of Harriet Tubman's life, her intertwined relationship with God and nature, which guided her activism and connected her to a collective of other women of her time. Through Night Flyer, Taya proves that even when it comes to the most heralded historical figures, there's always more to say. And today, she joins us to tell us all about her new book, Connect Past and Present, and offer lessons from Harriet's life that can help us build a future of collective liberation. Taya, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Kendall.
So first off, I just want to say congrats on the release of Night Flyer. I wanted to start us off here by asking about what compelled you to take on this project. You've written several books which chronicle research from the American South and Midwest, often bringing into view stories from our nation's history of slavery and connecting them to our present day. But I'm wondering what turned your attention specifically to Harriet Tubman, what made you pursue Night Flyer, and why this work right now?
Well, I've been studying enslaved women and families for my whole career. And several years ago, right before Hurricane Katrina happened, I became interested in environmental history as well. And this was sparked by a comment made by a colleague of mine at the time, the environmental sociologist Dorcita Taylor. She pointed out that given that I was so interested in the history of Black enslaved women, I might consider what she thought was a fact, which was that Harriet Tubman had to have been an environmentalist in order to orchestrate the various escapes that she helped people with out of enslavement. And this comment just floored me. I had never thought of Harriet Tubman in that way before. And then Hurricane Katrina happened that very next summer, and all the connections to me seemed quite salient about the ways in which environmental injustices are meted out to such a great extent on people who are marginalized and who have less, and the ways in which histories of various populations and individuals can help us to see these connections more clearly. So way back then in 2005, I started collecting information about enslaved people and the environment. Many years passed by. My notes were collecting and my file folders were getting fatter and fatter with this information. And then I ended up writing a book called Wild Girls, which just came out this past fall. And Wild Girls is a series of portraits of young women and girls in the 19th century United States and the ways in which their experiences in the outdoors in their youth helped them to explore all kinds of challenging questions and to work toward changing their society. And Harriet Tubman was the first girl I started with for this project. Then I had the opportunity to write a biography of her, and it was wonderful because in Wild Girls, I only had the space to talk about her growing up years, not to talk about her entire life. And so writing this book actually has been quite a long time in coming.
Yeah. I did not anticipate, Taya, that when I asked you this question, that it would lead to an answer that dates back to 2005. That's such a long time to be working on something like this. And my first reaction was just, wow, the diligence with which you share these stories is so impressive. I want to pivot a little bit to Harriet Tubman's life, because this book tells us so much that I never learned in American history throughout my education. And thanks to your work, I think a lot of people will get such a new perspective. In your book, you take us through Harriet's story from early childhood throughout her adulthood. But I want to situate us for a second in her teen years to talk a bit about her relationship with disability. As I mentioned in the introduction, July is Disability Pride Month. And at the ACLU, we like to share the stories of people past and present who have navigated disability as an identity. And Harriet Tubman has long been one of those icons that we've shared. But I think for a lot of people, this might be a lesser known part of her identity, although she and other women at her time were likely not identifying with disability or their disabilities in the same kind of cultural context that we exist in today. I think it's a part of her story that's really worth diving into. So she becomes disabled from an injury that happened when she was 12 or 13. For people who don't know this story, can you briefly describe what happened and how Harriet's relationship with disability began to form?
Yes, I will gladly do that. But I also want to go back to the way in which you framed this question, Kendall, and to underscore that language can really make a big difference for us in our ability to understand, you know, figures and events and processes in the past. And I also want to just expand our temporal frame a little bit as I respond to your question. I think it's important for us to go back to her very early life and to also see that Harriet Tubman is somebody who suffered from very serious illnesses from the time that she was a little girl. So this was back when she was called Araminta Ross, or Minty Ross, by her parents and her family and her loved ones. And as a child, Minty was leased out and rented out by the man who owned her mother and her mother's children. And she was leased out to people who forced her to work in unrelenting, dangerous circumstances. So when Harriet Tubman, little Minty at the time, was around the ages of 4, 5, or 6, she was leased out to a person who forced her to collect muskrats from his traps. And this was someone who was so cruel that even when Harriet Tubman became nearly deathly ill from going out into these cold, brackish waters without shoes, without proper clothing, without any protective gear, collecting these dead mammals from rusty iron traps, what he did was basically return her, viewing her as damaged goods, because she became so sick from this kind of work that she couldn't continue. This happened again and again in Harriet Tubman's childhood. So there is a pattern, a very serious illness in Harriet Tubman's childhood that was continuing even when she was a pre-adolescent and an adolescent and this terrible injury happened. So we're talking about what I would describe as sort of layers of disability. And what happened when she was around the age of 12 was she had, again, been leased out to a different person in the county where she lived. And this person had sent her on an errand to collect some items at the local dry goods store. She went there with an enslaved cook of this very same farm or plantation. And while Harriet Tubman was in the dry goods store. She saw someone who's, again, described in her As Told biography as, you know, a young Negro or a young slave. We don't quite exactly know his age, but this young person was running away from an overseer. The overseer was chasing him down. And Harriet Tubman put her own body in between the overseer and this young man, even though she had already been contending in her life with serious repeated illnesses. She put her body in between them. And when this overseer threw a very heavy metal weight, weighing, you know, about 2 pounds, at this young boy, it struck Harriet Tubman instead. It struck her in the head. The weight damaged her skull. She was knocked down to the ground. She was bleeding profusely. She was in terrible pain. She barely made it back to the place where she had been leased out to this other temporary, you know, master. And he turned around and put her right back in the fields the next day. And she remembers working in his fields. This is a terrible image, with the blood just dripping down her face. And afterward, she had just incredibly painful headaches, which could strike her at any time. And she also had seizures. And these are the moments that many observers described as Tubman would just, you know, quote, fall asleep, they would say. Well, now scholars are you know, fairly certain that this was not a case of Harriet Tubman just sleeping. This was a case of Harriet Tubman having seizures as a result of temporal lobe epilepsy, which followed from this terrible injury to her brain. And these seizures, apparently, according to observers, could happen as frequently as every 15 or 30 minutes.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, wow, indeed. When I think about what it was that she was experiencing and what it is that she managed to do despite this, I am just absolutely astonished.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And it's certainly remarkable that she didn't die from any of those circumstances. I wonder if, you know, I think for a lot of folks with disabilities, the, like, every day is kind of a scary venture. Every day is a little bit uncertain. As you described, Harriet having seizures sometimes as frequently as every 15 to 30 minutes that would kind of come at any moment. I wonder if so much uncertainty in an everyday way that somehow that created a level of courage in her. Do we have any sense of, from the materials available, how Harriet viewed these disabilities? Again, knowing that she likely did not have the language to describe them as such.
Yes. So in trying to think about Harriet Tubman's everyday life, I really attempted to pause exactly in the space that you're laying out for us right now, Kendall, which is the space of her disability and the space of her chronic pain, and to think about what would that mean for an unfree adolescent. I was quite struck by thinking about the pain, by thinking about the confusion, because we have to remember she was often not with her family at these times. By thinking about the anxiety, the fear of being someone who is utterly subject and vulnerable to the people who legally own you, and yet not able to control your own consciousness when you're out going about the tasks of your day. Would that mean having to do extra work at the end of the day? Would that mean extra exhaustion? I mean, certainly her owner, the person who legally owned her and who's leasing her out, thought she was worthless after this injury happened and threatened to sell her. So there are all of these dimensions that are hidden to us about Harriet Tubman's life that I tried to think through a bit in the book. Because as I think your question pointed out, we don't have a great degree of direct reportage from Harriet Tubman herself about her inner experience, about her subjectivity, about how she felt emotionally, mentally, physically. She herself was not able to read and write because that was forbidden. We just don't have the full story. And we can't go back and ask her how she felt about this particular issue. What we can get a sense of from these as told to biographies is that Tubman certainly suffered physical pain all the way into her old age, a pain that was so terrible for her that when she was quite late in life, she actually walked into a Boston hospital. This would have been Mass General Hospital, and just begged someone to help her with her headaches. And according to letters written by people who knew her at the time, she underwent brain surgery, basically. And according to them, without anesthesia, because the pain of these headaches was just so terrible, she was willing to do anything to rid herself of this pain. Here's something that's very important for how Harriet Tubman probably experienced her disability. And that is that while she had always been someone who had vivid dreams, after this terrible accident happened, Harriet Tubman started having waking visions. She started to hear voices, and she felt that these visions and this voice, that this was all coming to her from God. She was actually quite religious, and she had been since the time that she was a small girl. And so it seems quite likely, given how religious she was and how deeply she believed in God and believed in her faith, that Tubman took all of these new subjective experiences that were related to her seizures, and she combined it with her sense of faith and religious conviction. Which is not to say, I am not saying that I think that Tubman thought that her injury or her pain came from God, but rather that some of the connected symptoms or effects of this injury and of her pains came from God or were connected to God and her relationship with him.
Yeah, and this was so resonant to me personally, having been born with a disability, and, you know, that layered experience that you describe has been a part of my life as well. Something also that you wrote about that I thought was so interesting, you write about Deirdre Cooper Owens, who is another writer, and how she argues that we owe Harriet the respect to add the adjective disabled to Tubman's list of descriptions when we discuss her identities. And I thought that was also really notable because the idea of adding disability as an identity that is honoring Harriet's real lived experience is such flipping the kind of typical narrative about disability on its head, that it is a stigmatized identity. I found that to be really quite a powerful reframing of, I think, the way in which a lot of society still today receives disability. I wonder what you make of all of that, specifically in how Harriet's lived experience really kind of helps us shatter a lot of those stigmas that still exist.
I'm so glad you mentioned that quote by Deirdre Cooper Owens. It's, I think, quite an important one. It's very revealing. And also, Deirdre Cooper is working on a biography of Harriet Tubman, which will focus on disability as the central theme. So everyone should be on the lookout for the biography to come out in the coming years. But yes, I mean, I think that Didi was wanting to draw our attention in that quote to the ways in which Harriet Tubman's disability or disabilities were not only an essential part of who she was as a person, but also an essential aspect of her bravery, her courage, her commitment, and what it was that she was able to accomplish. And there's more than one way to think about this. On the one hand, we can think about it, as I think put it a moment ago, which is that despite all these things that she contended with, she still managed to move forward an incredibly visionary agenda around freeing people from slavery. But there's another way too, which is that because of everything which she was experiencing and contending with, she did this. We would not have her without her experience, these conditions, which were a very essential part of what made her who she was. And I think that's what Dee Dee, you know, also a friend and colleague, wants us to understand with this statement.
I want to needle in actually on this idea of Harriet as a spiritual figure and what Harriet's spirituality looked like. The idea that her disability perhaps led her to a new adoption of a new consciousness and supercharged her spiritual life, as you write in the book. I think it's important to distinguish that from the way that we talk about Harriet sometimes as a mystical figure. Can you tell us more about the way that Harriet has been represented over time and how you were so keenly aware of that representation and kind of debunked throughout this idea that because she had this kind of significant spiritual life and she did remarkable, courageous things, that she was somehow a mystical figure?
Well, even during her own day, Harriet Tubman was viewed by some observers as being mythical and mysterious and even exotic in a way that was quite racialized. And this includes white abolitionists who were her allies and who would count her as a friend. They still saw her as someone who kind of had this woo-woo quality, which they connected to her dark skin and sometimes commented on directly, and which they connected back to Africa, even though she was born in Maryland. And, you know, this kind of caricatured, stereotypical representation of Harriet Tubman's spirituality does her a disservice, and it does us a disservice, because it makes it seem as if the things that she accomplished were existing in some kind of fantasy zone. And it also makes her seem as if she were not in her right mind when she was making decisions in her life. And to us, it represents a figure who deserves so much more attention and study as someone who was just sort of acting in a way that we could never possibly understand because it was so exotic and strange and wild and bizarre.
It's the distancing that that kind of perspective gives people. They're like, oh, well, it limits people's ability to really like sit with the reality of Harriet, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. And even though people at that time who knew Harriet Tubman certainly felt that they were supporters of her, those comments were pejorative. I mean, there was certainly an aspect of those kinds of descriptions of her life and her actions that belittled her, that made her into a person who was less than the observer recounting them. But in fact, Harriet Tubman was not alone in many of her views. She wasn't alone in her risk-taking, and she wasn't alone in her belief that there was a spiritual dimension to life that she was always attuned to. This was a tradition. It was a way of thinking and being in the world that was also held by many other enslaved and formerly enslaved Black women and Black people. They were shared beliefs and actions that had been developed by a group of people who had been oppressed for hundreds of years in this country and had learned to survive together by developing a robust faith.
Right. Yeah. I feel like, yeah, it just always leads me back to the idea that, yes, it's pejorative, but at its minimum, it's a distancing. It's an allowance to just say, well, that's other to me, or, you know, Harriet was superhuman and I am not. So, and I think that just prevents us from having the moment to really reconcile with the history. As we kind of close our conversation today, I want to broaden to discuss a little bit more about this project as a whole, because there's so much more in the book that we don't get to talk about in this one singular conversation. So people have to go pick it up and read it because there's so much. But when you were kind of looking at this project as a whole, what are some of your biggest takeaways from this work that you think could really resonate with our culture today, particularly when it comes to things like activism and social progress?
So one big takeaway is something that we've already touched on, which was very important to me in asking questions about Tubman's life and trying to interpret her life in a way that I felt was faithful, there's that word again, to her experience. And that has to do with the critical importance of the environment and the natural world to her freedom vision and her freedom mission. Harriet Tubman would not have been able to escape on her own, let alone to individually help scores of other people escape. And later in her life, to help over 700 people escape in a military raid that she helped organize during the Civil War. If she had not been someone who knew how to live in and with the natural world, features of the natural world of all kinds, you know, trees, plants, waterways, rocks, stars, were consistently in her consciousness. And she used this awareness and information to carry out her freedom missions. This is, I think, really important for us because we need to remember that without our natural world, without our earth, we're really nothing. We can't exist. And if we want to try to maintain anything like the kinds of freedoms that some of us are able to enjoy in some countries in the world right now, we have got to be caretakers of our environment. To me, that's critically important. But there are many more things that I could bring out of this book. And let me see if I can squeeze in at least one more. Harriet Tubman and the other Black women of faith that I talk about in the book, who were members of her cohort, had a very strong view of equality and democracy. It's maybe hard for us to keep it in mind now, but when these women were doing a range of incredible things, like escaping their enslavement, standing up to abusive employers, being willing to preach when they were told that women couldn't speak in church, traveling alone, they were going against every dictate and expectation of broader kind of mainstream American culture. Harriet Tubman felt that slavery should end in the United States. She said that she knew a war was going to come to end it. And she felt this was right. She felt that freedom was actually God's cause. And I think that we can also consider the ways in which equality and democracy were values that these women upheld, even when they stood on the far margins and edges of their society, and they were able to advance their vision from these far margins and edges and to make a tremendous difference that we are still benefiting from today.
You just said so much there. I think there's a lot of opportunity, I think, to look at our society today and look at the people that are perhaps on the edges who are working to create social progress that we're villainizing today, that we will be heralding in 20, 30 years. This has been such a beautiful conversation. So cool to read your work. And I, again, highly encourage everyone to go check it out. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kendall. And I really appreciate your questions and their depth and sensitivity.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. Until next week, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Joy Smythe-McCauley is our intern.